Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, of course, the views of our callers. But please hold your calls tonight. We have with us Dr. John Wilkie, who is, of course, one of the great champions of the pro-life issue, having headed organizations both national and international, and now working full-time at Life Issues to try to educate the American people about, well, one of them we're going to be talking about tonight, and that is the issue of embryonic stem cell research. Now, people keep arguing about, you know, is stem cell research good? What can we do to help people? People who are perhaps are quadriplegic, people like Michael Falk, who have Parkinson's disease. Oh, if we could just do embryonic stem cell research, and certainly the administration doesn't want to help these people. And what they've done is totally confuse the issue. Well, one of the people who can really explain what's really going on is our guest this evening, Dr. John Wilkie. Dr. Wilkie, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, glad to be here.
So I'm going to let you explain what the difference is between stem cell research and embryonic stem cell research, and really some of the miraculous things that have been accomplished with adult stem cell research.
Well, Stan, I think one of the big problems today is that people, what we read and what we hear, very commonly simply says stem cell. Well, there's two kinds of stem cells, and what they should do is distinguish between the two. Now, this whole thing was just really discovered about 6 or 8 years ago. And literally every week I get something new across my desk that's been developed, or somebody's doing some research, or something's been discovered. But there are two kinds of stem cells. One is embryonic stem cells. The other, adult stem cells. And this would include the stem cells in the cord blood of the newborn baby or the placenta, the afterbirth. They're just a little different, but let's just figure there's only two kinds. Adult stem cells come from one of the organs of your body. We find them in your skin. We find them in the pulp of baby teeth. We find them in fat. We find them in bones. We're finding those stem cells almost anywhere in the body. And when we take those stem cells, isolate them, put them in a broth and culture, and they multiply and we get more of them, completely ethical. No one's complaining about this. Every church I know says it's great. I think it's great. The Right to Life people think it's great. Both Stan and I think it's great. Adult stem cells are totally ethical and fine. Good. Now, what is an embryonic stem cell? Well, we have to review our physiology a little bit here. Everybody knows that when sperm and egg join, we call this fertilization or conception. Okay? That's the first day of your life. When you and I were a single cell, and we each once were, we were human, 46 human chromosomes, we weren't a monkey. We were alive and growing, or we wouldn't be here. We were sexed, either male or female, from that first cell stage. And we were complete, and that's the most important part of this, because nothing was added to that single cell who each of us once were, nothing except oxygen and nutrition. All we have done from that time has been to unfold like the petals of a flower. All we've done...
Let's stop for just a moment, Dr. Wilkie. Be right back.
Okay.
Okay, go right ahead. Oh, please go right ahead with
what you're saying. Okay, fine. All we've done since that first cell stage is grow up. because everything we are today was in that first cell. The color of our hair, the fact that you've got big feet, the fact that you'll get diabetes when you're 50, that's all in that first cell. So that's the important thing we start from, okay? Now, when you then were one cell, you began at the second day to divide into two and then to start to grow up. For the first day of your life, you floated down your mother's tube, and when you were 1 week old, you planted in the nutrient lining of her womb, of her uterus. Then, over the next two or three days, you sent roots into the wall of her womb, tapped into her bloodstream, and sent a chemical hormonal message into her bloodstream. That was carried to a gland at the base of her brain, and it carried a message to her body. And the message was that there's a new little passenger down here. Don't menstruate. And she didn't. And because of that, you are here, and I am here. Okay, let's go back to that first week now. If at about the fifth day of your life, as you floated down your mother's tube, we stopped, grabbed you, so to speak, and cut you open, then we could find embryonic stem cells in the middle of your tiny little body. Now, in order to do that, we had to kill you. But then we had embryonic stem cells. So that's how we get embryonic stem cells. We get embryonic stem cells by killing a five-day-old living human, little boy or girl. So I don't think that's a very good idea. I myself think we should respect the life of every living human, no matter how old or how young or how crippled they are. So that's strike one. We think it is immoral to take embryonic stem cells because we do it at the cost of the life of another living human. So, adult stem cells, completely ethical. Embryonic stem cells, not a bit ethical. You're murdering this little kid. Now, what do we do? Well, what are stem cells? The two of them are very primitive. And from these cells, all of the organs of our body will develop. Because when you first began, you were a single cell. When you were a week old, you looked like a mulberry.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Dr. Wilkie. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Wilkie is certainly describing simply the process of fertilization as it occurs, and then we end up with a zygote. And so you pick up this story there. Now we have this fertilized egg that's a zygote, and, of course, this is what's going to be a sacrifice to get the embryonic stem cells. Dr. Wilkie, you pick up the story.
Okay. Now, with the discovery of both adult and embryonic stem cells, the scientific world has been all abuzz because we're beginning to find uses for these cells. All right, let's take an adult stem cell, and let's say we took it from this man's skin. But this poor man has had a bad heart attack, and the one wall of his heart is very flabby and thin, and it's failing. Now, what we've been able to do in a few cases, and it's happening more and more, is to take his own adult stem cells, inject them into the wall of the heart, and these cells then seed out, form new heart muscle, and strengthen his heart. Now, that's never happened in the history of the world, and the reason it is that, you see, most of your body, let's say you get a cut in your skin, well, it heals, doesn't it? You break a bone, and it heals. You cut away half of your liver, and it regenerates. But heart muscle does not regenerate. Neither does your nervous system, and neither does the skull cap on the top of your head. Those three organs do not regenerate, and therefore, if something happens to one of them, like you cut your spinal cord, you're paralyzed the rest of your life. Okay, so what we're finding out now is that if we take that same person's adult stem cell and inject it, let's say, into the break of the spinal cord, well, let me tell you a story. Senator Brownback from Kansas here a little over a year ago had a press conference in Washington, and he called and two young ladies with braces and walked up to the microphone. Now, what was so unusual about this? They had both been completely paralyzed with severed spinal cords from an accident. They had gone to a famous, he's famous now, research surgeon in Portugal who cultured their own adult stem cells, injected them into the area of the break in the spinal cord, and it began to heal the two ends together, and they were walking. In my own Life Issues Institute, we have a half-hour TV show, and this is just being polished now. It'll be aired probably around the first of the year. We interviewed a young lady from Indiana. She had an accident. She was about 19 years old, and she was paralyzed from the waist down. She went to Portugal, had this done, and you'll see her on our TV, our half-hour special, as she walks up to talk to us. Now, that's the first thing in the history of the world. And it's absolute magic. A lot of things are being done here. We're injecting animals' pancreas. Now, that's a gland that's the upper right corner of your abdomen, and it has something to do with digestion. There are little islands in the pancreas that we call islets of Langerhans. That's just a big name we gave it. And these little islands produce insulin. Those of you who know anything about diabetes know that that's a disease when your body no longer makes enough insulin. Insulin helps you burn sugar. And if you don't have enough of it, you're ultimately going to die from your diabetes. Well, we replace that insulin by giving you shots. If it isn't too bad, we can manage it with pills. But now what we're doing in animals, not humans yet, we are injecting their pancreas with stem cells, and little islands are growing back and are producing some insulin. So it may be that we've got the cure for diabetes. But understand, we're using adult stem cells. Now, let's turn to embryonic stem cells. The reason the California referendum passed, and many of you know that you all voted for $3 billion to be spent on, what do you think? Embryonic stem cell research. And who do you think financed it? Well, the biotech industries did, but there was a lot of money out of Silicon Valley from some very wealthy people who had children with juvenile diabetes. And they were convinced that if they gave enough dough and it was researched enough, that embryonic stem cells might be able to cure diabetes. Well, God bless them, no one told them about adult stem cells, which are starting to do it. So let's look at embryonic stem cells. That's where all the fuss is right now. We're being told now, Mr. Fox, the movie actor, you know, he's been on the air saying, vote for this, vote for that, so that we can have embryonic stem cell research so that, and this man has Parkinsonism. Parkinson's disease is a disease that tends to hit us when we're older, and it causes constant shaking. You've seen people with hands trembling constantly or their head nodding constantly, and as they walk, they sort of shuffle, their legs are very stiff. Well, this is something going wrong with their brain, and we don't have a cure for it. So it's a single cell that doesn't work. Okay, that's the kind that the scientists like to shoot for. They're never going to cure Alzheimer's because it's multiple cells, but this one's a single cell. So Mr. Fox says if we can use embryonic stem cells, we'll maybe cure Parkinsonism, which he has. Well, there is a research report that came out within the last month. I think it was from England. They used embryonic stem cells to treat Parkinsonism in mice. And what do you think happened? The cells they injected into their brain to try and fix this problem turned into cancer. Not good. We had one instance of a man in China who had Parkinsonism, and they used embryonic stem cells. They injected them into his brain. He died a year later of a brain tumor. The brain tumor on autopsy had skin cells, cartilage cells, kidney cells, bone cells, a whole bunch of different kind of cells that had grown wild, formed a cancerous tumor, and killed him. Well, that's a problem with embryonic stem cells that has not been solved. And so because embryonic stem cells cause cancers, no one is yet using it in this country to treat humans. They're trying, as I've mentioned, in animals, and what they're finding out is that it causes tumors. But you're not being told that by Mr. Fox, and you're not being told that by most of the press and so forth.
In fact, here in California, they voted last year, Compassion, the people voted for $3 billion for embryonic stem cell research with no justification for it at all, other than the plaintiff pleas of Superman and, of course, of Mr. Fox, $3 billion for a technology that's totally unworkable. And, of course, when we have a stem cell, adult stem cell research, which is having such exciting results, and the American people, certainly the people here in California, aren't being told that they've been hoodwinked.
Well, you know, Christopher Reeves was one of the ones who pushed for this, and Nancy Reagan, bless her soul, means very well, but she's been talked into thinking that with embryonic stem cells will cure all kinds of things. Well, right now, adult stem cells are being used in humans and are treating 70 different human problems. How many human problems are being treated by embryonic stem cells? None. Zero. Zilch. And one of the main reasons is that they form tumors. But there's a couple of other reasons why embryonic stem cells aren't being used. You see, the embryonic stem cell comes from another living human, another person, who has a different DNA. Now, if we take those cells and put them into you, what does your body do with that? It rejects them, just like it would a planted kidney. Now, maybe we can keep them alive with anti-rejection drugs like we do in a kidney transplant for a while, but that's not the best answer, and it's only temporary. So, the embryonic stem cells are rejected by the person who receives them. Let's think of another one. Let's give an example. Here is a lady who died earlier this year. She willed her organs, and four of her organs were transplanted right after she died into the body of four different people. Well, what they didn't know was that she harbored an infection that her body had controlled but wasn't evident. Three out of the four people died from the infection that they got from her organs. Now, that can happen with embryonic stem cells. Let's say the person who donates the embryonic stem cell has AIDS. And let's say you're the recipient, and you get those cells. Friend, you got AIDS.
Well, you
can carry infection.
You hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Dr. John Wilkie. And it's so important you understand there's effective treatment, and the American people are being simply lied to. Well, Dr. Wilkie, you go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, so I've just given you three reasons why embryonic stem cells don't work, can't be used in humans, and at least on the horizon in the next few years, there's no possibility that they will. But we have the alternate. We have the adult stem cells. Adult stem cells, they told us just two or three years ago, were hard to find. No longer. We now can find plenty of them. Adult stem cells, they said, couldn't be produced into the various organs like the embryonic ones would. Embryonic can grow into anything, as we've known. They grow too much. But adult stem cells now are being growing into almost any organ in the body. And, all right, let me give you another one here. I mentioned that your skull cap does not regenerate itself. So if, let's say you have a son who's in an accident, and the top of his skull has been fractured and depressed, and they have to remove a lot of the bones up there, and he survives. What do? Well, they put a plate in the skull. Most of you have heard of people who've had accidents who have skull plates. Now, why? Well, the bone does not regenerate. It won't grow back. That's one of the three parts in your body that don't grow back. And so you put a plate in, and that's it for the rest of his life. Until a little girl in Germany, this is about a year ago now, had an accident. The top of her skull was torn away, but miraculously, the brain was not injured. And they were literally looking at the top of her brain, and they could see it pulsate. Well, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to put a plate in, of course. But then the researchers up there did a very imaginative thing. They took some of her own bone from her hip, and they ground it up into a paste. And then they took her own adult stem cells, I think in this case from her bone marrow, and mixed them up. And they put it across the top of her brain like you'd put butter on bread. And what do you think? The skull cap regenerated, real bone, again, for the first time in human history. Again, adult stem cells. They took them from her own body and put them back in her own body. So, now I've said there's three major objections to embryonic stem cells. One of them is it can carry infection. But hey, if you take cells from your own body and put it back in your own body, no problem. Another one is that embryonic stem cells can be rejected. They're foreign tissue. It's a different DNA. Your body rejects foreign tissue. But if you use your own adult stem cells and put them back in, you don't reject your own tissue. That's just fine. Finally, the embryonic stem cells grow wild, and they cannot be controlled. Adult stem cells are not quite as primitive. And we are finding out that we're able to control the adult stem cells. You put them in a pancreas, and they'll only make those little islands. You put them in the heart muscle, they'll make heart muscle. And so it goes with various places and parts in your body.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. John Wilkie, and we're just talking about embryonic stem cell research and really what a fraud it is. And Dr. Wilkie has pointed out three reasons why it should not be used. First of all, of course, you cannot control what these cells are. They're very, very primitive. They may produce kidney. They may produce tooth. They may produce bone. They may produce all sorts of different types of tissue, and we call them teratomas. They produce tumors many times where they're injected. Secondly, of course, embryonic stem cells come from somebody else, and the body tends to reject them. And third, of course, there may very well be infection in those tissues you're getting from somebody else, whereas you use your own adult stem cells. Why, of course, they can be trained many times to replace the tissues they want. You're not going to get an infection. You're not going to reject them. So please pick up the story there, Dr. Wilkie. I think that is so important.
And okay, the thing is, let's turn the page and talk about cloning. because that's absolutely part of what this is all about. You've all heard of cloning. A lot of people don't really understand what it is. Let's just say we're going to clone, let's say you're a young lady, and we're going to clone you. What does that mean? If we could create a human clone just like you, we would be producing an identical twin sister for you, only she'd be a tiny infant. But just as we have identical twins, who are, of course, the same age, if you had a clone of yourself, you would have an identical twin. Well, over the years, we've talked about cloning, and way back a ways, they did clone frogs. And we call these amphibians. Frogs are cold-blooded, and their physiology is much simpler, and they were able to do that. However, mammals, that's us, warm-blooded, fertilization inside of the female, the young grow inside of her and are delivered and are nursed at her breast. That makes us mammals. We're much more complicated. And I was always taught, and I'm sure Stan was, that you'll never clone a human. Well, they did clone a mammal. It was a sheep. And many of you remember 5 or 8 years ago, Dolly the sheep in Scotland. She was the first mammal who was cloned. Oh, boy, this was worldwide news. If you can clone a sheep, then maybe someday you can clone a human. And Dolly looked normal. In fact, she had a little lamb when she was a year old. But then what happened? She rapidly aged. She developed old age arthritis. She developed chronic pulmonary fibrosis, that is, old age loss of function of her lungs. And when she wasn't quite 3 years old, they had to put her away. Now, that can happen to a sheep at age 10 or 12, but this was premature aging. So Dolly, while she looked normal at the beginning and even had a little lamb, nevertheless, there's something wrong with her, and this happened. So, what's been the other thing about Dolly is that it took 300 failures to get one Dolly. Well, what's a failure? A failure would have been a clone that grew up to a certain few weeks or maybe months and then died. Or it could be a cloned lamb who they looked at the little one with ultrasound and found out she had 5 legs, so they aborted her. Or she was born, but with gigantism, that is, rapidly developed many times the size she should have been, so they put her away, and so it went. Well, it took them 300, and they killed the bad ones, the defective ones, and finally they had Dolly. Okay, they tried and they did clone a dog in Korea. How many did it take? 1,000 dogs were sacrificed and killed or died spontaneously until they finally got a dog. His name is Snoopy, and maybe some of you have seen a picture of him. He's a nice-looking hound. But it took 1,000 tries. Okay, translate that into humans now. Are we going to clone a human? Well, let's say the baby looks like it's got 4 ears or 2 heads or something awful. Would we then automatically kill that human? Everybody wouldn't quite agree with this. So what they're saying is that they don't want to clone a human and bring that human to delivery. And they call this reproductive cloning, and really nobody wants to do that yet. However, there is another type called research cloning, and they like to call it therapeutic, but there's nothing therapeutic about it at all. Therapeutic means treatment. And that is that you would clone the animal, or maybe clone your little human.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. John Wilkie. All right, Dr. Wilkie, we were talking about cloning, so you picked the story up there.
Okay, fine. There's two kinds of cloning. One would be the research cloning or therapeutic cloning. And in that case, if you were successful in creating and starting to grow a tiny little cloned embryo, you would experiment on this little human and then kill him. That's what they do with animals now, and that's what they plan on doing with humans. They don't want to bring that baby to term because of all the abnormalities. But let's back up a minute and say, well, what is a clone? Well, let's try this. You take a woman who has an egg, unfertilized, but an egg. Now you remove the center of the egg, the nucleus, and you throw it away. What you've got left now is the empty shell of her egg. Okay? Now we want to clone you. Okay? So we'll take one of your skin cells and we'll remove its center, its nucleus, and put that in the empty shell of this lady's egg. And then you do some hocus-pocus here and one thing and another and a little electric and try and fool this new fertilized egg into thinking that he or she is exactly that, and this little tiny human would start to grow. Now, that would be a human clone. Well, why do we want to do this? Well, scientists always want to do things, but there's another big reason why they want to do this. This one would probably not be rejected if you used the embryonic stem cells from this clone, because it has your own nucleus in it. And you wouldn't, it says here, reject that embryonic stem cell that came from that cloned human that was made from your own cell, your own nucleus. Well, it's not quite that simple, because there are substances in the shell, what we call cytoplasm, that would react. And there's quite a bit of that. If we take size here, a woman's egg, let's say it's a basketball. Just think of size. The sperm is the size of an ant crawling on the basketball. The nucleus isn't much bigger than that ant.
Hold that thought right there, please, Dr. Wilkie, as we bring the other... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Wilkie is just describing this process of cloning, if it were going to be done in a human being, and how, of course, you'd take the woman's egg, and you would actually take out the nucleus, and then you'd take one of the cells from a human stem cell from the same person, and then, of course, you'd take out the nucleus, and then you'd join them together and stimulate electrically and get it started to actually begin to grow. So pick up the story there, Dr. Wilkie.
So anyway, the idea about cloning is that you would clone the human, which would be an identical twin for you, grow that little human until he or she is 5 days old, and then cut them open, which kills this little human, and extract from the inside embryonic stem cells, which then you would use for treatment. So that's the idea. It has never been done. And we don't know if it ever will be, but there's a lot of people trying. Now, there's an interesting thing about this cloning. The medical name for this is somatic cell nuclear transfer. We doctors think up big, long names, and this confuses patients and all that, but that's the technical name for cloning. But guess what? Tomorrow, there's going to be a vote in the state of Missouri. And there's a vote there to put a big sum of money, appropriate it, and a constitutional amendment. And people are going to vote on this. Well, guess what? If you read the first paragraph of this, you're in the voting booth, it says, "This is not cloning." But then if you go down quite a few paragraphs into the body of the description of this amendment, it says, this is somatic cell nuclear transfer. So, you know, it says it wasn't A, but it is A. And so the people who put this thing on the ballot obviously were trying to fool people. So our pro-life friends, they went to court on this, and they said, you can't do this. That's just simply flat-out lying. You're saying it isn't cloning, and then a few paragraphs down, you say it is. Just use a different name. Well, believe it or not, it went right up to the highest court in the state of Missouri, and that judge ruled that it was not confusing, and it could stay with that kind of terminology. Well, needless to say, pro-life people have been fighting uphill ever since that happened, and if we don't know, it's going to be a pretty close vote. There's the other thing that this thing does in Missouri, and that has ramifications for the whole country, is that it promotes and allows hyperovulation of women so that they can get the eggs to work with. What does that do? All right, here's a woman who's going to volunteer. We stick her with needles and pills, and we load her up with huge doses of hormones, which stimulate the growth of eggs in her ovary, and then she's, if you please, ready to hatch, to lay a whole bunch of eggs from her female organs. Okay? Now they go in with a little periscope through the wall of her abdomen and suck out those eggs. And I'm going to use them then for cloning. Well, what's the story here? It so happens that when we treat a woman to produce what we call hyperovulation, lots and lots and lots of eggs, that this really does disrupt her own body's cycles. And it can be very dangerous to this woman. As a matter of fact, it can so upset her female cycles that she'll never really be the same again. And worldwide, there are a fair number of women who have died from the after effects of what they call harvesting the eggs. Now, that word harvest is another one of those names. Gee whiz, harvest, fall. Crops are in. That's good. Harvest is a good word. So they adopted it and said, we'll harvest these eggs. As a matter of fact, they stick something in her belly, and they pull these eggs away from the ovum and suck them out. And as I say, this can be deleterious. It can harm her, and it can even be fatal. But this Missouri thing, then, would allow and stimulate and pay for hyperovulation of women, and that, of course, so that they can get the eggs, and then they're going to use those eggs to experiment and try to make some human clones with them, and that's on the ballot tomorrow.
And, of course, the average person in Missouri, I'm sure, has no idea what they're really voting on, do they, the implications of this?
Well, you know, Stan, you and I go in the voting booth, and let's say we're just average people who haven't followed this too closely, and here's this proposal. So we read the first paragraph. It says, this is not cloning. This will cure a zillion diseases, and this is a wonderful thing. Oh, well, I'll vote yes. But, you know, if you knew the medical terminology and went down the line a little bit, you would say, but this is somatic cell nuclear transfer. Hey, that's the medical name for cloning. And that's what they're trying to fool people with.
You know, they're just so really diabolical. What they're doing is they're playing God. This is really what it's all about. We're going to improve on God's plan for our human reproduction. And I'm really very, very concerned that if God is just, one of these days he's going to bring his punishment on our society.
You may be right, Stan. We're they twist the language. I said this is called therapeutic cloning. Well, what is therapy? Well, we all know what therapy means. It's treatment. Therapy is curing an illness. Therapy is treating a disease. Therapy is good. So they call destructive experimental cloning, in which the tiny little human is created and then killed, they call that therapeutic. Well, they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes on that one, but we just have to know what's going on in order to understand and hopefully teach others so that they're not fooled by this.
And, of course, there's absolutely no reason this has any advantage over adult stem cells, is there?
No, there is no advantage by embryonic stem cells. None at all. We were told yet only 2 or 3 years ago that there were advantages. First of all, that there weren't very many adult stem cells. Now, we know that there's zillions of them. Gee, just in cord blood alone, there's trillions of these cells. We were told that they couldn't develop into an awful lot of the organs that they needed, and the embryonic stem cells could. Well, now we have them developed into almost all the organs of the body, and embryonic stem cells we can't control. So I don't think in another 5 or 10 years it's possible that we won't even be using embryonic stem cells at all, because they will not have solved what looked like insurmountable problems now. And in fact, there'd be no need to, because the adult stem cells work so well and have almost no side effects, and they're plentiful, and they work. And
really, this is one of the great, most exciting things that has come along in medicine for a long period of time. And yet the average individual is so distracted by all this talk about embryonic stem cell research that he doesn't really know what's happening with the adult stem cell research. And we're certainly not hearing about this through regular channels. Well,
Stan, many years ago, Moses came down off the mountain, and he brought down 10 commandments. He didn't, as our preacher says, they weren't suggestions, they were commandments. But in any case, that law has long since quit being a religious law, and it has become a civil rights, a law in every country in the world that is absolutely essential for an ordered society. We don't go around killing people, and if we do, the laws in every country in the world will punish us. Okay, let's start with that. But what do you think New Jersey did a year ago? They passed a law to appropriate money to do embryonic stem cell research. But there was a little caveat there. This one said, you may, if you can, clone a human, and you may experiment on that human, but you cannot plant that human in a woman's womb so that she delivers a baby. It's okay to kill a 1 week, a 2 week, a 3 week old human by cloned human, but if you don't kill them, you go to jail. How about that? First law in the history of the world that instead of forbidding killing, mandates it and punishes you if you don't kill.
Well, I think we're in real trouble morally, certainly in America today. And I think the average individual really doesn't understand the implications of what's going on. It's almost like Dr. Frankenstein is at work in America today, and nobody's really concerned.
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, it's sort of interesting to look at maybe another aspect of this. Research, scientific research, costs money. Okay? Now, we know that we have these two kinds of stem cells. And there is research going on. So far, so good. Who is funding the research for adult stem cells? Well, your taxes are doing it in some areas. That's fine and dandy. That's the way it ought to be. But also, there is private money going into adult stem cell research. And the reason is that they hope there'll be discoveries there. And we call this venture capital. You know, if you invent a little widget, Stanley, and you think, well, I got something here. A lot of people want this. I got the idea. I don't have any money. I can't produce it. So you go to a guy who's got a lot of money, but no ideas. And you two get together. You use his money and get into production, and you make a lot of money, and you split the dough. That's a venture capitalist. So venture capitalists have money, and they want to invest it with the hope of making more. Okay, there are venture capitalists who are investing in adult stem cells, and we do have government money in most states going into this in one way or another, including heavily the federal government. Okay, how many venture capitalists are putting money into embryonic stem cells? Well, gee, you'd think a lot of them would, because it has something that adult stem cells don't have. Let's say you did use embryonic stem cells, and let's say you discovered a cure for diabetes by using these. You could patent that, Stanley. And if you could get royalties from that, and you could get rich as sin. So there's money to be made if embryonic stem cells would work out. But the people with the money who made it aren't stupid, or they wouldn't have the money in the first place. And they're looking over the prospects for embryonic stem cells curing diseases, which they could make money off of. And their judgment is that the embryonic stem cells aren't going to cure any diseases. So there's almost no private money going into embryonic stem cell research. Ah, but scientists want to experiment. And that's the name of the breed, and nothing wrong with that. But they need money to do their experiments with, and they're not getting it from any private sources. So where are they going to get the money? Your taxes, buddy. And so that's what they did in the state of California. They tapped the public purse, and they're using that $3 billion to do embryonic stem cell research, even though there's very little evidence that it will bring any results.
Well, I think the most interesting thing is, Dr. Wilkie, that there's lots of money being invested in the adult stem cell research, isn't there? Private money?
Yeah. And some of that can be patented, some of it cannot, but private money is going, just follow the dough, private money is going into adult stem cell research, but not into embryonic stem cell research, and so they want to use your taxes, and as such, you frankly haven't heard almost anything about adult stem cells. All you've been hearing about is embryonic stem cells and the great promise that these will hold. And, you know, Christopher Reeves came in his wheelchair and said that if we put this California money to work, somebody could cure the spinal problem that he had. And, of course, he didn't survive. He's gone to his reward. But, as I mentioned at the beginning of this program, we have now, I know of four young women who had accidents and had severance of their spinal cords. And these, they were paralyzed, and they have used their own adult stem cells, injected into the break. And all four of these women are walking. And we heard of one fairly recently from Korea. Wasn't up to walking on her legs, but she was able to crawl across the floor using both arms and both legs, and she had been quadriplegic.
Well, John, before we go on, let's go ahead and get your website out. People would know how to get in touch with your organization.
Well, anybody who's interested could get our website. It's the three W's, and it's Life Issues, www.lifeissues.org.
And because let me recommend...
LifeIssues.org.
LifeIssues.org. I get the material. I read it with anticipation every month or several months when it comes out. How often do you put your newsletter out?
Every quarter.
Every quarter. Well, anyway, whenever it comes, I always read it because it's always got so much great information. That's LifeIssues.org. Our guest has been Dr. John Wilkie, who's been at this in this battle, this pro-life battle for, well, ever since I can remember, and I've been around for 40 years or more, so he has certainly been a leader in this movement, gave up his medical practice, and is doing this full-time. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment. Of course, well, John, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay, are we done now, Stanley?
No, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Okay, fine.
Just go ahead and say what you'd like to say.
Well, I think the reason that all of this started was that we've lost respect for the value of human life at its earliest stages. And it's now a proven scientific fact, of course, that each of us began as a single cell, and all we did was grow up. We don't kill big people. We don't kill babies after they're born. We shouldn't kill the same baby before the baby's born, no matter how early that little baby is in his or her life. And if we observed that, I think a civil right to life, if you're a religious person, you'll call it the sanctity or the sacredness of human life, and a large command not to kill, then we wouldn't have any of this mess. But we can't appeal to religious sensitivity to a lot of people who don't buy that sort of stuff. But we can say that this is a human right. And the fact that you have your life protected is a law of the land, because the most important single function of a government is to protect your most precious possession, and that is your life itself. And how early in your life should you have your life protected? We think right at the beginning. But there are people out there who don't think so. They draw a line in time. And they say, yes, this is human life. Yes, it's killing. And yes, it's innocent. But before you get to a certain age, we will kill you. And that's the law of the land right now. And we're trying to change that.
Well, I certainly hope you can, because I think the one important thing for everybody to realize is that every human being is a unique being made in the image and likeness of God. There are no two people in the entire world that are the same. And until we understand, of course, that you kill somebody, there will never be another one like them. You never know what they might have accomplished had they been allowed to live. And yet society has made this decision. We have women making the decision. We have abortionists making the decisions. We have politicians making the decisions. What I think we really need are people who fear God and realize that human life really is very, very precious. Dr. Wilkie, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and I really appreciate you bringing us up abreast of this fascinating, fascinating subject.
Okay, don't forget to vote tomorrow.
I won't, don't
and
you worry.
Vote for the guys who will protect human life, not those who will take it.
God bless. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and of course, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, which is how we're able to be on some 60 outlets every week, and on shortwave and internet and satellite and regular radio stations somewhere in America 5 hours a day. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a copy of this program on cloning, on adult stem cells and the exciting things, of course you can always get a copy of the program by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then I think it's so important that people really understand that behind everything that's going on today, there is truly a spiritual battle going on. What really energizes many of the people involved is an intense hatred for human life and humanity as such. Now, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you really need to get the book, you need to read the book, you need to understand what is really going on and the spiritual forces are behind what is taking place. We do hope many of you want to get some of our exciting new four-tape sets. One of them is called The Truth About the Holocaust. What really happened in the Holocaust? Well, I think you'll find this four-tape set fascinating. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on the North American community, the demise of national sovereignty. There is a program. It's called the Security and Prosperity Partnership, and it will be the end of sovereignty of America. Of course, immigration fits into this, the reason they are actively encouraging illegal immigration, and the leaders of both political parties are doing that. If you really think they're going to build a 700-mile fence along a 2,000-mile border, well, you're sadly mistaken. It's all symbolism over substance. It's all to give you the impression they're doing something. But they still have a catch-and-release program where people come across our border illegally from countries other than Mexico, who are, you know, many of them may even be from terrorist countries. They may be Muslims coming in here. They don't know if they're terrorists or not, but don't you worry. We're not going to discriminate against them. We simply hold them overnight, tell them to come back in a month or two for a deportation hearing, and you'd never guess. Most of them never come back. They call it catch and release. That's how we're fighting terrorism in America. That's how we're fighting, trying to protect the American people and preserve our way of life. You need to get the four tapes set on the North American community. And then, of course, we have a new four tapes on medical myths. We have a four-tape set on the impending police state. We have a four-tape set on concentration camps, or we actually have videos that will show you the camps. And we have, of course, a testimony given before the Iran-Contra hearings when Congressman Jack Brooks is trying to get the information out about the plan to suspend the Constitution and declare a dictatorship in America. And it was constantly interrupted by Senator Inouye. You'll actually see the video footage from the Iran-Contra hearings. And then the statement by Congressman Henry Gonzalez, longtime chairman of the House Banking Committee, as he says there really is a plan, in case of civil disturbance, to suspend the Constitution and arrest American citizens and put them in detention camps. They have recently authorized $385 million for Halliburton, Dick Cheney's old company, to build those detention camps. They have passed new legislation, the John Warner Authorization Act, which allows them to use the American military against American citizens, not against terrorists, because we're not fighting terrorism. The new, certainly the Military Commission Act redefines terrorism. Anybody who opposes the government is a potential terrorist. Both of these pieces of legislation were passed on the 17th of October of last month, just last month. And most people do not understand. We no longer have the Posse Comitatus Act. We no longer have protection against government bringing troops in over the objection of local governors. We are moving rapidly away from freedom towards fascism and the loss of all freedom. But then, you know, what would you expect in a nation that's turned against God? Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, this evening we're hoping to have with us Johanna Michelson. And those of you who do not know Johanna, Johanna was a medium, and she had the supernatural gift of being able to contact the other dimension. And when she was a young woman living in Mexico, she was actually recruited to become a psychic healer. And she attended many sessions with this woman, this older Mexican woman, who could perform these truly supernatural surgical feats. She could reach into somebody's head and pull out a tumor. Now, how do you reach into somebody's head and pull out a tumor? I mean, in the material world we live in, that sort of thing cannot happen. But in the other dimension, all sorts of things can happen. And Johanna was really so taken with this, and she was thrilled to think that one day she, too, would be able to carry out these miraculous feats, and people would come from all over Mexico, indeed all over the Western Hemisphere, for these treatments. And of course, many of them, most of them, were actually cured or appeared to be cured of the terrible inflictions that they had. And then, of course, her sister, Johanna's sister, kept telling her that this was demonic. This was not of God. And but Johanna said, how could this not be of God? This is wonderful, these things are happening. And of course, what happened, of course, was that eventually Johanna went off to Switzerland and spent some time there with Francis Schaeffer, eventually came to realize that what she was witnessing truly was supernatural, but it was not of God. But right now, to our good friend, Johanna Michelson. Hi, Johanna, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Dr. Stan. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Well, have we got the phone worked out?
Well, no, not really very well. I've got a problem with the unit I usually use. It is giving me a very difficult time.
Well, let's just, this one sounds pretty good, so let's go. And I just sort of introduced you. I'm going to let you pick up the ball and run with it.
Well, what are we picking up and where are we running?
Well, you just told me you wanted to talk about the things we've talked about in the past, your supernatural experiences there in Mexico, and then where this has all led you, realizing that there is another dimension. There's a spiritual dimension that most people do not recognize. And you, of course, experienced this when you were a young woman in Mexico and working with as sort of a sorcerer's apprentice.
All right.
Go ahead.
Well, Dr. Stan, it's good to be with you tonight. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the nature of deception since we spoke last. And there is such a massive, overwhelming preponderance of evidence that indeed we are, I firmly believe, living at the very end of the end times. Those times of which Jesus himself spoke when he was asked what would be the signs of the end of the age and of his coming. The Lord warned us in Matthew 24, and we're all familiar, I'm sure, with the passage, most of your audience is, I'm sure, Dr. Sten, about the wars and the rumors of wars and the frightening things that we're seeing now, nation rising against nation, the earthquakes, the famines, the plagues, the betrayals. But the one sign...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Johanna, go ahead.
But the one sign, Dr. Stan, that Jesus mentioned not once, not twice, but three times, was a warning about spiritual deception. He said to his people, see to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. Then he tells us in verse 11, that many false prophets would arise and would indeed mislead many. And then in case we didn't get it the first two times around, he tells us again that false Christs and false prophets would arise and would show great signs and wonders so as to mislead even the elect. And I believe firmly, Dr. Stan, that we're seeing that. You know, I myself experienced the world of the occult and the supernatural from the time I was very young. And back when I was growing up, the story was somewhat unusual. It sadly no longer is. Countless millions of people are encountering and experiencing supernatural phenomena, the awareness of another dimension in which terrible things happen, frightening things happen, and certainly also the other side, things that seem appealing and beautiful happen. And for me, it started when I was about 11 and a half, when something moved into our home, slammed doors that my father had locked twice with the only key, stomped down the stairs, terrified the dogs, woke up my sister. My sister and I were growing up in Mexico at the time. And from that point on, Dr. Stan, something had moved into our home, which gave me an overwhelming awareness of the fact that there was a dimension that was very real but unseen, and yet a sinister terror that was as tangible as the chair I'm sitting on right now as we speak. I began to become increasingly aware of the fact that I was developing psychic abilities as I grew older, knew what people were thinking, which was rarely what they were saying, had an uncanny ability to know what was going to happen before it happened. Many of our audience, I know, are familiar with this. And went all through my college days, being labeled a weirdo at best and a witch at worst. Weirdo I was, witch I wasn't, not by the Wiccan definition of it today, but really at a loss, Dr. Stan, because I felt at the mercy of these forces. I didn't know what to do with them. But when I got out of college, I went back to Mexico, where my father and mother were living still at the time, and my father came across an ad for...
Hold on, though. We'll be back in just a moment with Johanna Michelson. Well, this is Dr. Stan. You go right ahead, Mike and Johanna.
My father came across an ad for a group in Mexico, in Cuernavaca, called Silva Mind Control. Today they call it the Silva Method. And it's one of many different mind control or mind development groups, psychic development groups, which was teaching us to develop the genius potential of the brain, supposedly. And what they were doing, basically, Dr. Stan, was teaching us how to become psychics and how to get our spirit guide. Sadly, it's the same kind of thing that a lot of the kids in our school systems are learning this very day, and even in a lot of the Christian schools, and what a lot of people, even in the church, are learning how to do. And we'll be talking about that as we go along. But when I got involved with this mind control group, Dr. Stan, I felt really as though God had given me the answer to my prayers. I finally now was learning how to control the forces that had pretty well buffeted me at will, the faces that would show up, the manifestations, the terrifying sense of a presence. I was learning now how to weave around myself a white light of protection that gave me a sense of peace and security. I was learning how to meditate at a deeper level using the techniques, by the way, that are virtually identical to those now being promoted in the contemplative prayer movement in the church, practicing yoga and learning now how to gain a mastery over these forces that I had received no answer to, not from the Catholic nuns in the school I went to or from the so-called priests in our Episcopal church, who were, it turns out, more involved in the occult than I ever knew. And through these people in Silva Mind Control, Dr. Stan, I was introduced to my personal spirit guide. Of course, they didn't call them spirit guides then. They probably still don't. This was my wise person, my counselor, my friend, whom I invited into my laboratory. And when I was told that we would need this counselor who would come and work with us at a psychic level to give us information and to help us produce good effect and positive healing in the lives of people around us, I thought, what better counselor could I possibly have than Jesus Christ? After all, I was a Christian. I'd accepted the Lord as my personal Savior my freshman year in college. I had asked him to come into my life. Somebody shared the four spiritual laws with me. And I knew on the basis of the Word of God that if I died that moment, that I would go to be with the Lord. Dr. Stan, everything about this Jesus seemed so right. When he manifested in this special psychic laboratory that I created in the silence, this quiet meditative place that we were taught to go into using the same kind of techniques, very similar to first-level hypnosis induction techniques, similar to the kinds of techniques used in the guided imagery visualization practices now introduced and which had been introduced in the churches for many, many years now, I saw this being who looked like every picture of Jesus I'd ever seen. And I thought, how wonderful, it's true. Jesus said he stands at the door and knocks. I opened the door and here he is. And of course, so was Sarah Bernhardt. I was a theater major, not that I could act my way out of a paper stack. But I thought, well, I could use some acting tips, so I invited Sarah Bernhardt. She actually showed up, wooden leg and all. And I was convinced now, Dr. Stan, that I was on my way to doing something positive. Now, as I was working with Silva Mind Control and practicing now yoga, because I was getting involved in that as well, something very popular in the Christian realm today, I was also introduced to a woman in Mexico City who had been for some 40 years or more at the time, Dr. Stan, doing astonishing things. This woman was one of the few genuine psychic surgeons in the world, documented extensively by some of the top researchers in the field, Andre Puharich, Stanley Krippner, Alberto Villoldo, many other researchers who were not easily duped. And this woman, Dr. Stan, would go into a trance state sitting in front of a simple altar in the slums of Mexico City, an altar that was covered with flowers, with weird packages wrapped up in bells, with jars of flowers and roses, with a crucifix and a picture of Jesus. And then, of course, there was also the statue of Hermanito Cuauhtémoc, the Aztec prince who claimed to be the spirit who was coming back to work these miraculous healings and cures through Pachita. She would sit down. We would begin to pray the Lord's Prayer. She would go into a full trance state, and someone else would come and take possession of her. She was a full trance medium. And this spirit would come, Dr. Stan, and do astonishing things. You're a medical surgeon, and I know, as I've shared my story with you and our audience in the past, I can almost feel the eyebrows raising because I'd be raising them myself. This woman would take the rusty hunting knife and in the power of this spirit would literally cut open the patient lying on a cot with no more benefit of antiseptic than a bottle of new alcohol that was opened and splattered around, no more anesthesia than taking a few deep breaths and relaxing, the patient totally awake. And Dr. Stan, all I can tell you is I had my hands in it. I assisted personally in over 400 operations because this medium, when I met her, it was after the surgeries. She was sitting on a cot, puffing on a cigarette, her arms crusted in dried blood. We got in there too late the first time I went there to see the operations. And she looked at me and took my hand and she said, "You're a medium, aren't you?" Now, that was a term I'd never used for myself, but somehow it seemed to fit. And she told me to continue my studies with Silva Mind Control, to come back the next week, and that she would begin my training. And I went for 14 months, Dr. Stan, assisted personally in over 400 operations. I saw cataracts removed. with the woman sitting there with her eye wide open as a bottle of alcohol is poured into the eye without a moment of pain or flinching on her part. Some kind of a scum is peeled off, and the woman is bound up, her eye bound up. She's carried out. The next week she comes back. The cataract is gone. The doctor can't figure out what happened. A man who had an inoperable brain tumor lying on the cot on a plank that was brought in especially for this, because this was a different kind of operation. His skull, Dr. Stan, literally cut open. I know how this sounds. I know how this sounds. I would have thought I was insane or lying as well if I'd heard this story as well. All I can tell you is that this man's skull was cut open. My hands were on either side of the skull. I could feel the hands inside there through the bone. As Pachita was wiggling around and pulled out a stench of a tumor. The man's eyes crossed as we were speaking. I was holding his hand. I was speaking to him, and he's telling me, I can't tell you how weird this is. I can feel his hands inside my head. What is this? What is this? And then when his eyes crossed, he was really freaking out because he couldn't see straight anymore, literally. And Hermanito said, well, that certainly won't do. And he sticks his hand back in the man's skull, wiggles around, and the man's eyes straighten up. He was bound up. Months later, when I went back and checked on him, and over a year after that, when I went back and did some research and was checking on him, the man's tumor was completely gone. The doctors had no explanation. Dr. Stan, I saw what I could only explain and understand as miracles. And the point is this, Dr. Stan, my experience told me that this had to be from God. Everything that I had experienced in my early years with the presence of the beings, with the door slamming, with the frightening phenomena at Wesleyan College in Macon, Georgia, and at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, all of the fearsome manifestations and the gruesome things that would sit on the side of my bed, all of that was driven away as I would weave this white light around myself. And now, practicing yoga, doing the hatha yoga, the meditation yoga, the mantra yoga, which is such an integral part of contemplative prayer today, my experience said this was from God. And you know, the frightening thing today, Dr. Stan, is how now, I believe in fulfillment of the word of God and prophecy, you see now that millions of people are yearning, are seeking for that experience that gives them a sense of the transcendent, a passion for that immediate transcendent experience of God, and people don't much care. Certainly, at least according to Newsweek magazine that came out with an article in 2005 on the subject, cover article called Spirituality in America, where it said that millions of people now are embracing a desperate search for a deeper understanding and relationship with God, and whatever it takes to get that experience, they are willing to do it. And this isn't just in the Christian perspective. The pagans, the neo-pagans, the Wiccans, even the Satanists are experiencing a tremendous burgeoning. The Muslims and the Sufis are experiencing great resurgence and interest in devotion to God. The Buddhists certainly as well are experiencing that through the meditation techniques. But what has really been unnerving for me and for others of us, Dr. Stan, and I know you yourself as well, you've been speaking about this and trying to warn your audience for a very long time, is that there is a desperate danger in basing what you believe about God on your experience taken over and above the inerrant word of God, which is no longer something that's even believed in an awful lot of churches.
And I think that's really, really what it's all about. Everybody wants to experience God. Everybody wants a supernatural experience, as if somehow that's going to draw us closer to God. But that supernatural experience in truth may be actually dragging us away from God and, of course, misleading us dangerously. Go right ahead, Joanna.
You know, the thing I think, Dr. Stan, that made the difference for me in my leaving the occult was the fact that more than anything else, I wanted to know the truth. Back in 1972 now, I would have been in 73. I'd been working with the medium for 14 months. I had decided that this was what I was devoting my life to. I had decided that these experiences were so wonderful, and the joy of seeing people healed and feeling that my life was worth something and had value was so overwhelming that I determined that I was going to devote my life to that. But there was someone in my life who kept doing the most annoying thing, saying, "Look, Johanna, I know your experience is astonishing. I know that you are convinced and totally believe because of your experience now that this is from God. But how do you know? Is there any source of absolute truth against which you can test your experience, against which you can compare the two and say, you know what, this is valid and blessed of God, and no, this is dangerous and I've been deceived? On what basis can you tell?" And that is one of the most important questions, I think, that Christians, especially those who say or think or would like to think that they take the Bible seriously, would be asking themselves. Because if there is no source, Dr. Stan, of absolute truth against which we can compare our experience, then on what basis are we going to be able to discern what is from God and what isn't? If we can't learn at this stage, in the end times, when the Lord Jesus Christ himself warned us in Matthew 24 and in numerous other places, verse after verse after verse, warning us not to be deceived, warning us to be on the alert, because our adversary the devil prowls about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour, 1 Peter 5:8. The thing is, we have been so completely undiscerning that I'm afraid that most of the churches I'm looking at it is right now looking more like a nice steamy plate of lamb chops that has already been half devoured than it is like the flock of the Lord Jesus Christ, because we have totally ignored God's command to be on the alert. You know, you're seeing it in every direction. The emerging church, for example, Dr. Stan, and I know you've done numerous programs on the issue of the emerging church now. The church that is seeking to minister, supposedly, to the younger generation, to be relevant, to fill the void of the empty ritual and the old-fashioned way of worshiping and the old supposed orthodoxy that is no longer relevant for today. And there are those in the ministry, and understandably, who are seeking relevant ways of ministering to the young people today. And what we have seen in their yearning to do so, and in the correlation between that and the overwhelming, desperate need to experience something, that swing back from the pendulum when back in 1966, you know, we had the old arid theology that told us that God was dead. Well, God wasn't dead. What was dead was the old form of doing things, the old church structure.
Hold that thought there. We'll be back in just a moment with Johanna. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Johanna is pointing out the fact that so many people today want to experience God. They're looking for some sort of a supernatural experience to know that it's true. And of course, rather than sticking to the scriptures and what it says in the scriptures and learning about God that way, and now, of course, we want something. Wouldn't it be nice if each of us could have that supernatural experience? The only trouble is, can we be sure it's coming from God and not from the other dimension? And one of the biggest problems is, Johanna, that most people, most Christians today, do not realize that we live in one dimension, but there is another dimension there, a spiritual dimension, and there really are beings that transcend from one dimension to the other and can, of course, encounter us. And, of course, they are deceiving. They are trying to lure us away from the truth. So you pick up the story there.
Well, the thing is, Dr. Stan, not only are they trying to lure us from the truth, but because there has been such an attack on the reliability and the validity of the Word of God as source of absolute truth, that concept now is anathema even to many pastors and many leaders in the church, as we'll see in a moment. What is absolutely terrifying is that now practices that once easily from Scripture could have been identified as being something God would not bless have now been brought into the church, and we're being told by people, for example, like Tilden Edwards, who's the founder of Shalem Institute, one of the biggest institutes teaching contemplative prayer, that what makes a particular practice Christian isn't its source, but its intent. So what they're telling us now, Dr. Stan, is it doesn't matter if you want to bring in yoga, if you want to bring in ancient Buddhist meditative practices, mantra yoga, if you want to bring in ancient occult techniques of pranayama and deep breathing, if you want to bring in any form of ESP or occultism into the church, what matters is your intent, not the source of the practice. And I will tell you, at that point, you are seeing the fulfillment of Scripture about even the elect being deceived, because what you have done now is totally eradicate and remove any possibility of testing the spirits to see whether they're from God. How on earth are you going to do that if all you've got to rely on is your intent? And really, when we started to see the swing, Dr. Stan, was in the 60s, because at that point you had out in the one of the monasteries there, Catholic monastery, St. Joseph Abbey, a Father Thomas Keating, who was sitting there in Massachusetts, and they were very deeply involved in many of these practices, all of these things of contemplative prayer, meditation techniques, deep breathing techniques, have all been a part of the Catholic Church for centuries. It was brought in, actually, by the early Desert Fathers. And the early Desert Fathers were the small groups, isolated groups of men and women, monks, nuns, who in the early Middle Ages would gather themselves off in a desperate and sincere yearning and desire to come close to God. And off in the Middle East, in the desert, there, they would gather in the small groups and practice whatever technique they could find to give them an experience with God. And what was a little unnerving then is it didn't much matter to them. It was a time of experimenting, and they didn't have many guidelines at the time, and it didn't much matter to them what kind of technique. So that when you had the meditative techniques coming through Alexandria in Egypt, picking up the Hellenistic and Roman influences, the mystery religions, the Gnostic tendencies and approaches and belief systems, the ancient Hindu practices, the meditation techniques that were an integral part of the yoga system, they simply said, oh, just like Tilden Edwards, what makes a particular practice Christian is not its source, but its intent. Okay, these techniques of contemplative prayer and meditation are being used by the Buddhists, or later on the Buddhists, and the Hindus and the mystery religions, but we are going to use it to glorify Christ. And then in the 60s, Father Thomas Keating brought in a Zen master into their Trappist monastery saying, you know, if we're having these great religious experiences here, maybe there's something now that we could use to deepen it. And they brought in the great Zen master, Roshi Sasaki, to lead a retreat at the Abbey. And they had an incredible time, powerful spiritual techniques. And they said, ah, now, can we find a Christian tradition?
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Johanna Michelson, and we're talking about really, of course, the history of the extension of these mystical approaches into this Catholic abbey. So pick the story up there. These people are searching for a means of experiencing God. There is a Catholic unit, and they've even brought in somebody from the Eastern mystical religions. And how are we going to experience Christ? Go ahead.
And so they had this wonderful experience with the Zen master, Roshi Suzaki. And then Father Thomas Keating, the abbot of the abbey there, said to his Trappist brother, Father William Menninger, look, see if we can find a Christian perspective to this. And sure enough, one day in 1974, he comes across a dusty old copy of a 14th century guide to contemplative meditation called The Cloud of Unknowing. And it draws on the work of one of the writings, as well as on the writings of St. John of the Cross and Teresa de Avila. And they began teaching a form of, quote, Christian meditation that really has now grown into a worldwide phenomenon, Dr. Stan, and it's known as centering prayer, which really is the lifeblood of the emerging church. That emerging church, which is seeking to minister to the young people, the young generation, that is bent on experience. So now here, they have the perfect venue for bringing these people into what they consider an experience with God in a Christian perspective. The only problem is, with these centering techniques, is that they're realizing, and they knew it even then, that these were identical to the Buddhist perspective, to the Buddhist approach that the Zen master Roshi Suzaki was teaching them in their monastery. And it was inevitable that they would find those similarities because they have the roots in the same place. The contemplative prayer now is focusing on basically one thing, a philosophy and a theology that says, God is bigger than just this personal being. God is a force. God is all around us. We are one with God. And what we need to do is to get back and remember that we are a part of the divine. We are in paradise. We've just forgotten it. And through this practice of centering prayer, in which we sit in a quiet meditative state and take a word, a single word which we can say over and over and over and over again.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Johanna is describing the techniques that are being used, certainly within the emerging church, the centering prayer technique that is being used, and taking one word and repeating it over and over and over again. We come into almost an alpha state, into a hypnotic situation where our minds are open to the beings from the other dimension to come in and take control. Pick the story up there.
And of course, Dr. Stan, they would take grave exception to phrasing it that way, that we're opening our minds to other beings to take control, and yet that is exactly what is happening. Contemplative prayer isn't biblical prayer at all. It's a type of mystical meditation that is designed to put you in an altered state of consciousness. It's something that's going beyond thought, and it's seeking to provide an experiential union with whatever. They're calling it God. But the question is it God? And, you know, as you're looking, Dr. Stan, at these practices, the contemplative prayer, the deep breathing techniques that now are being promoted by Rick Warren in his purpose-driven book. You know, do the breath prayer where you're breathing in Jesus and you can say the word over and over again, or Jesus have mercy on me, a sinner, and you're breathing out the negativity and the fear and the all the stuff that you don't want to be a part of your soul. And you're doing this until you're feeling and sensing that experience with the divine. And what you've done, Dr. Stan, is now left yourself open in neutral to something very, very different. And how do we know? All right, let's get back to what the Word of God says. The Word of God, as we are looking at that, gives us some pretty clear guidelines about the influences from the East. It gives us some very clear direction about what God has to say about those who were bringing in the practices of other gods. You know, in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 6, for example, it tells us that, and here, let me find the passage for you exactly. It says, "You have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob, because you were filled with influences from the east, and they are soothsayers like these, like the Philistines." Isaiah chapter 2, verse 6. And here we are now bringing in influences from the east and saying these things are going to be blessed from God because we're so sincere. Actually, Dr. Stan, I think one of the things the church needs to take hold of is that sincerity does not act as a kind of magical protection against demonic intrusion or deception. There isn't a single verse anywhere in the Bible that assures us our sincerity alone is going to protect us or guarantee us automatic immunity from spiritual deception. And that is something I think that the church simply doesn't want to deal with and will not acknowledge. They feel if we're sincere, if we are moving into an area that makes sense to us, then on what basis are we going to say that this isn't from God? People like Leonard Sweet, for example, also one of the leaders in this movement, a futurist and a professor, who's written a couple of books now that I found rather unnerving on many levels, Quantum Spirituality, for example, a postmodern apologetic, in which he's talking about the trends of the future. And there isn't an occultist or a New Ager that he doesn't praise and hold in high esteem here, from David Spangler, a metaphysician, to Matthew Fox, one of the great heretics that even the Catholic Church has recognized as a heretic. And he's talking about how really we, unfortunately as Christians, have kept in good repair prejudices against what may be God's other sign language of the fourth dimension, also known as the fourth psychology. And he's saying, really, what a shame, because here you've got millions of people across the world who know that there is this other dimension, extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, the mind's ability to alter matter, the out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, remote viewing, all the things that you're seeing, for example, on Medium or these other programs on TV that are so popular now. And he's saying, yeah, you know, it's unfortunate that the church, fearing the stamp of lunacy, is remaining antagonistic or indifferent, even broaching a subject about which everyone seems to know something. He said millions of people are involved in occult experiences, but oh, how unfortunate and how tragic that the church is ignoring it and turning its back on it and is saying, oh, we don't dare go anywhere near that. It's too frightening. But he's saying, look, the postmodern culture is very superstitious. 73% are avoiding walking under a ladder, and they'll step into a street to avoid doing that. 1 in 4 believe in ghosts. 1 in 6 communicate with a deceased. 1 in 4 communicate telepathically with another person. 1 in 10 claim to have seen a ghost or felt its presence. 1 in 7 claim to have seen a UFO. 1 in 2 believes in ESP. 1 in 4 follows astrology. How many people are checking their astrological chart to see whether they should get out of bed in the morning? And he's saying the church must not sweep mysticism under the rug. The paranormal is normal. Extrasensory perception, ESP, is real, not imagined or schizophrenic. Mystical experiences happen. And he's right. Mystical experiences do happen. The question is, how do you tell the difference between what is of God and what isn't? And people, as you're listening and sorting this out, if you are going to go testing your theology only by it feels right, I had a wonderful experience, then you need to know, in accordance with the Word of God, you have left yourself open to some frightening things, because God has a very dim view of those who practice the kinds of things taught by the contemplative prayer, going into an altered state of consciousness, seeking to become one with the divine, seeking to develop psychic and mystical abilities and powers, seeking to communicate with the dead. And you know, Dr. Stan, as I was thinking about a lot of these things around the time when I was involved with Pachita and practicing yoga, and this person in my life, my sister, kept asking me the question, Johanna, you're having these beautiful experiences. You believe you're seeing Jesus. You believe as you're chanting your mantra and as you're communing now and going into your deep trance state that you're following God and that what you're experiencing is from God. How do you know? And I had to admit, Dr. Stan, all I had to go on was, it feels right. I had nothing else. It feels right. And then I reached a point where I said, well, what if I've been deceived? What if these mystical experiences I'm having through ESP and psychic phenomena, through the practice of yoga, which I was convinced was something that was helping me commune with the living God. I used it to worship the Lord, even as these people now who are writing these books on Christian yoga believe that they're doing. Not understanding that it's an oxymoron. There is no such thing as Christian yoga, any more than there is any such thing as Christian Buddhism or Christian Sufism and Muslims or Christian Wiccans. And yet, I'm looking at stacks of documentation right now. You can download it on the internet about the Christian Buddhists, the Christian Muslims, and the Christian Wiccans, and the Christian Luciferians. Because they will not test their experiences against the Word of God. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 9, states the following, and I think, church, it's important to listen to. The Lord was giving us a warning, and Moses was speaking to the people of Israel before they were to enter the Promised Land, and he said this, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not learn to imitate the abominable things of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, which was a vile form of child sacrifice practiced by the Canaanites in those days. I suggest to you that while we may not see human sacrifice as much, at least in this country, to the god Moloch or Lucifer or Chemosh or Tanit, that the God self is every bit as much of a deity and a divinity, certainly in God's perspective. Self is as much of a false god as any of these other deities, and that when we practice abortion and wipe innocent life from our life because it's inconvenient, that is as much human sacrifice to the God self as anything spoken about here in the Old Testament. But it was interesting to me, Dr. Stan, to see what God included with human sacrifice. Or one who uses divination, astrology, the tarot cards, the I Ching that Carl Jung was so fond of and wrote a foreword to one of the translations for, the Ouija board. There are hundreds of thousands of different forms of divination, of seeking through occult hidden means information about the future. Or one who practices witchcraft, sorry Harry Potter and sorry Hermione, witchcraft is something called abomination before the living God. And he doesn't differentiate between the black ones, the white ones, the red ones, the polka-dotted ones, the really creepy, scary ones that you'll see in the Harry Potter movie coming out in the next few weeks, or the wonderful, cute little ones that are going to Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. All of them are labeled abomination here. Or one who interprets omens, the superstition. A lot of horses are running around to this day in their stocking feet because farmers keep putting their shoes on the door to keep the luck from running out. Or a sorcerer. Again, sorry, Harry Potter. One who casts, and by the way, sorcery comes from the word pharmakia, the use of hallucinogenic drugs to put you in the same kind of altered state of consciousness which the contemplative prayer movement is achieving through the use of a mantra, through the use of the meditation techniques taught by the Buddhists and picked up by the ancient desert fathers and translated into the church, and then introduced even to the evangelical church through Richard Foster and Thomas Merton, whose one goal in life before he was electrocuted in India on a pilgrimage there to learn more about Hinduism and Buddhism was to become the best Buddhist he could possibly become. Or one who casts a spell, or a medium. Oh, that would make me sit up, Dr. Stan. I was a medium. A medium is simply a go-between, someone who thinks they can communicate with the other world, the world of the dead, and indeed they can. The question is, with whom are they communicating? Or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For whoever does these things is detestable to the Lord, and because of these detestable things, the Lord your God will drive them out from before you. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God. For those nations which you shall dispossess, listen to those who practice witchcraft and to diviners. But as for you, child of God, the Lord of your God has not allowed you to do so. You know, I have to wonder, Dr. Stan, as I read passage after passage, do not learn the way of the heathen. Do not become involved with those who practice witchcraft and listen to diviners. Isaiah chapter 8, when they say to you, let us consult the mediums and the wizards who chirp and mutter, should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? He says, the law and the testimony, if they don't speak according to this word, the revealed word of the living God, it's because they have no dawn in them. And Dr. Stan, that statement right there is a vile, politically incorrect, horrendously offensive one to an awful lot of pastors, big name pastors in the church, who now, because of their practices, are saying, look, if we are having the same experiences as the Buddhists and the Sufis and the Muslims and the Wiccans and Neo-Pagans, if we, through the same techniques of contemplative meditation, taking of the word, whether it's Jesus, 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 or Om Mani Padme Om, or Om over and over and over again, if we're contacting what we believe, surely, must be the same source of divine, then on what basis are you, you narrow-minded, Bible-thumping fundamentalist, going to sit there and say to me that what I'm experiencing isn't from God? And what's happening, Dr. Stan, is we, because of the open door now to all of these experiences which flooded in with the Beatles in the 60s, the drug culture, they're bringing in Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and the transcendental meditation, the flooding in of all the seeking after the mystical and the meditative and the experience that we are all so desperate for and longing for. What is it that's happening? Why are we seeing this? I believe it's because we are looking at the fulfillment of Scripture. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, we are told about one who is coming, one who will be rising up now. And we are told in 2 Thessalonians 2 not to be deceived. After a while, you get really sensitive to the fact that Scripture time and time and time again says to Christians, wake up, stop being deceived, test the spirits to see whether they're from God. Let no one in any way deceive you. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. For it will not come first until the apostasy comes, that man of lawlessness will be revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. That is, it says in verse 9, the one who's coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish. And now listen to this, audience. Because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false. People, that is what's happening today. Today we are seeing a flood of people who, because of these mystical experiences, are feeling, believing, experiencing that they are one with God, that they have that divine goodness inside of them that they have now tapped into, that higher self spoken about by the Hindus and the mystics for generations and for millennia. And once they've experienced that, when the Antichrist comes and says, I am God, we won't be taken by surprise. There are countless of Antichrists, little gods running around. And when one comes displaying great power and says, I am God, they're going to say, yes, you are. He's just bodier than the rest of us.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Johanna. Well, Johanna, I agree with everything you've said. You know, the thing is that the Bible is so simple. It's not complex at all. People don't want anything simple. They want to make it complex. They want to feel it. They want to experience it. And yet, of course, Christianity is intellectual. It is not spiritual. It is not feeling good. It's not how you feel about what you believe. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have a web page or any way that people could get in touch with you if they wanted more information?
Dr. Sten, I can be contacted through my publisher, Harvest House. But, you know, they will get it all mailed to me, and I'd be happy to correspond through that. But, you know, the one thing I want to end with, Dr. Sten, is people be alert, because what you are doing when you go and cling to these other practices is very much like the sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10, who decided they were going to come to God their way, never mind what the Bible had to say. And they offered strange fire before the Lord, which he'd not commanded them, and the Lord executed them for it. People of God, we do have a personal relationship with the living God. It isn't, Dr. Sten, I believe, just intellectual, because we come to God with our whole heart as well as our whole mind. But if you are judging and gauging your belief in what God is, in who God is, in who Jesus Christ, his Son, is, based on your experience, and an occultically based experience at that, then you run the danger of following after another Jesus, another spirit, another gospel, and worse, a danger of hearing the most horrendous words anybody could hear that Jesus spoke about when he told us to beware of the false prophets in Matthew 7, who come to you in sheep's clothing, pretending to be good, pretending to be godly, pretending to be sweet, pretending to be men of God, like Brian McLaren, one of the 25 top evangelicals, according to Time magazine a couple of years ago, who says, hell is the worst advertising God ever had, and shouldn't we be thinking of Jesus more like Mahatma Gandhi or like Martin Luther King rather than this exclusivist? At that point, you will hear the words of the Lord saying, depart from me, you workers of iniquity. I never knew you, and I don't care how many times you called me Lord or prophesied or cast out demons. If you're following another Jesus whom you've conjured up or allowed in because of a cult-based experience, and you have not tested it according to the Word of God, you've got the wrong one, and he will not save you.
You were out of time. Good night. God bless. Well, our guest has been Johanna Michaels. And Johanna, thank you so very much for being with us this evening. And I hope we get you to come back again. I think everything you say is so true. And there is such spiritual deception all across our land, all across the world today. So, Johanna is gone. And so this is the time when I really need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you'd like to get a copy of this evening's tape, and remember, we do talk through the breaks. Why, they're available through Radio Liberty, as all of our tapes are, and we have many tape sets. We have Cindy Johanna's book, The Beautiful Side of Evil. We have our interviews with her, The Supernatural. And if you'd like to get other interviews with Johanna, they are available through Radio Liberty, and you will learn and benefit so much from them. So I remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. One of the most dangerous issues before the church today is this phenomenon of the secret. The book, the DVD, pushed by Rhonda Burns, it is an occult practice, and millions of Americans are adopting the law of attraction and dooming themselves to eternal removal, exclusion from God's kingdom. We have a four-tape set entitled The Secret Behind the Secret. It's available in tape or CD. We hope many of you will want to get that. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on Satanism and Deliverance, a four-tape set on Aleister Crowley, a four-tape set on the wisdom of Malachi Martin. All of these things will begin to introduce you to this other dimension. And it's not imaginary. It is real. And you want to avoid it under any and all circumstances. Certainly, we hope that many of you will want to get my talk, Brotherhood of Darkness. It's available in DVD or VHS. And, of course, you'll want to get the book and have that to document what I'm telling you. You want to get the talk, The Forbidden Secret. And, of course, the syllabus that goes with that, which you can end. And then we certainly would want to get our talk on the Iraq, the Untold Story. It's the history of all the wars of the last century, and it comes with an excellent syllabus. And that syllabus gives you all sorts of documentation. You'd want to get Hidden Agenda. Goes into how they're poisoning us and our children with water fluoridation. You'd certainly want to get my talk on the financial tsunami, which is about to engulf our nation and destroy the monetary well-being of so many of our people. And that, of course, comes with an excellent syllabus. And if you'd like more information, go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Or please, of course, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like, of course, to get copies of the tape of this program, or I'd like to learn about getting the other items we mentioned, 1-800-544-8927. And then, Chris, we want you to understand, although we talk a lot about politics, although we talk a lot about history, and we talk a lot about medicine, and we talk a lot about financial matters, we feel this is all really spiritual in its foundation. And if you haven't, of course, read my little pamphlet on the history of money, it goes into the man who really began modern banking practices with interest, a man named Sir Francis Bacon, who was part of this mystical group of the Rosicrucians. If you'd like to know more about them, the two DVDs, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings and Riddles in Stone. That's The Secret Mystery of America's Beginnings and Riddles in Stone. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.